Well, thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation, which was most enjoyable. I feel honored to come here, and thank you very much for coming. Nothing would be more embarrassing than to give a talk where nobody turns up. Let me emphasize, that's never happened to me, but I don't want it to happen either. So thank you very much. I chose this title, Giant Volcanic Intrusions, without totally appreciating that I should have put the intrusions in big letters, because that's really what it's going to be about. Intrusions of one fluid into a stratified fluid. I'm going to talk mainly about volcanic intrusions into the atmosphere, because that's what was in my mind when I did this work and what the paper is really about. But you could imagine intrusions of silt-laden rivers into the ocean. You could imagine intrusions of pollutants coming from a chimney stack into the atmosphere. There must be lots of industrial examples also where you have fluid of one density going into a stratified system, intruding into a stratified system, and that's what I'm going to talk about. But as I say, I'm going to emphasize volcanoes, but you can think of river flows or whatever you like. Except when you see the photographs, it's a little difficult to think of this as, other than a volcano. This is an eruption in Kamchatka, a rather typical style, thank you very much, a rather typical style where the ash-laden hot fluid, partly liquid and partly gaseous, goes up into the atmosphere, and then it's influenced by the wind and goes downstream. Now, you all know of these sort of intrusions. There was an intrusion in Iceland some 3, 4, 5 years ago of a volcano whose name I can never pronounce, so I call it E, which caused enormous difficulty to planes. Now, the beginning is a plume like this that comes up and can go 40, 50 kilometers into the atmosphere, really quite high. The important thing that this is a turbulent plume, as you see here, even though this is a static picture, doesn't take much imagination to see the turbulence that goes on here. And I was told that the two organizers are working on turbulence, so they see this, and all of you do, I hope. The important thing about plumes like this is that there is an inflow velocity that is proportional to the vertical velocity with a proportionality constant that's about 1/10. And so what that means is a volcanic plume like this takes in relatively cold atmosphere from here. It heats up the atmosphere because there are a lot of hot ash particles, about 800 degrees centigrade. It heats up the air, and that makes it less dense than the surroundings, and so up it goes. So it goes up to 40, 50 kilometers, I'll show you in a moment, because of thermal energy, not because of kinetic energy. It's not that it's thrown up 50 kilometers into the atmosphere. It would go really only a few kilometers at most. The speeds here, 70, 80 meters a second, but that's not enough to get it to go. This was made famous by Morton, Taylor and Turner in the damped laboratories just 400 yards away. Well, they weren't there in 1956. Well, they're still 400 yards away. Everything in Cambridge was 400 yards away. Morton, Taylor and Turner in 1956. Well, what happens then? Well, I'd like to show you a little experiment. Now, this experiment is really just for fun. If I did it properly, I'd bring a big tank here and fill it up, but I didn't want to carry all of that. This is not a perfect experiment in the sense that there are close walls here, but it shows you, I think, what you want. Now, can you all see it, or would it be better if I used my computer as a camera and put it up on the screen?
Put it on the screen.
Put it on the screen, okay. Command tab it is, isn't it, that gets me there? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's meant to... Oh, it does show the experiment. There we go. Yeah. Okay. So I have some water here. It doesn't prove it's water. It could be vodka or something like that. But is it water? Well, the last time she saw it and got it for me, it was water. And I'm going to add some red dye so that we can see what goes on. And you see how carefully I add the red dye. Everything is done very accurately here. And then I need to... No, I better not do that. Oh, I better not use that either. I put my stirrer away. That stirs it and makes it equal. Thank you. Okay. Now I'm going to take some of this red dye. The red dye makes no difference to the density. It just allows you to see it. Water into this stratified system. This is a stratified system. I made it before. It's really very salty on the bottom and totally fresh on the top, and this is fresh. What's going to happen? Well, that's the one of the wonderful things about experiments. I have no idea what will happen. I'll see. Could squirt all over me and my new pink shirt. Well, we see it's coming up and it spreads. Even though the density here is considerably greater than the density of the input fluid, what happened is it entrained fluid, just as I had on the last slide, it entrained the salty water, and so it couldn't go all the way to the surface. But when it came to a level of the same density, having brought the salt up, it intrudes. One of the last times I showed this experiment, somebody put their hand up and I think seriously said, but does that mimic volcanic conditions properly? No, it doesn't. Volcanoes are very rarely in thin places like that. But it's just to show you the idea. Right, so here's an example, and this is not constrained by walls. This is the eruption of Redoubt in 1989. There's a lot of detail here which I don't want to go into. Have I already lost the... Oh, I lost it down here, didn't I? Which I don't want to go into, but basically there's a plume that went some 10 kilometers into the atmosphere and then spread as it intruded, because the atmosphere is also stratified. As you know, it gets less and less dense as you go up. That's why it's difficult to climb mountains like Kilimanjaro, which I hope to do in 2 or 3 weeks. And it spreads out and it gets thinner. Do you notice here? You can also see it here, that the thickness of this intrusion decreases as we go along. Now, using Morton, Taylor and Turner, the ideas there, but putting in volcanic conditions, a undergraduate student of mine, Andy Woods, who's now the director of the BP Institute, evaluated how high the eruption should go as a function of the volume eruption rate, because the stratification in the atmosphere and other details don't change much. It's the eruption rate that plays the largest role. And then plotted all these volcanic eruptions, and you see there's really quite a good fit, and Bessemiani in 1956 is the highest one that we know that happened in our time. As like many of these things, there are lots of little eruptions. Eruption frequency is quite frequent. For example, Unzen here, Etna, erupts a little less frequently and a bigger size until you get to Yellowstone, which everybody is terrified, which could erupt tomorrow. We don't know. Well, not tomorrow, but next week. Tomorrow we'd know. There'd have to be some magma movement. Maybe even next week. Next month definitely could happen. And that would... I can't help saying that would destroy Trump totally. I've never had the opportunity to say that. Or never before had the opportunity to say that. Just to give you some indication, there was a British Airways flight that was flying in 1982 at night. All was going well, everybody was happy, the passengers were sleeping, and suddenly two things happened at once. One was all four engines stopped. And two was the pilot looking out the front window saw this. Now the question I'd ask you, imagine you're the pilot, four engines stop, and you don't see nothing. One thing I can tell you, he could have looked through any book he wanted to, even on the ground. There was nothing that would have told him what to do. He was totally up in the air. Now, what would you guys do? But, yeah, that's not a bad idea. Whether that would save you is an interesting lecture, but not in fluid mechanics. What else would you do? Fly down. How do you fly down? You've got no engines.
Glide down.
Okay, you glide down. Why do you do that?
You want to get the density of air up to try and relight the engines.
Why don't you relight the engines up here?
The density is very low.
Yeah. Well, you're right, but for the wrong reasons. Which is, well, it's better than nothing. It's better than saying wrong. And anyhow, the point is, if it touched the engine reigniter, it would have totally destroyed the engines, because he was going through a volcanic eruption, which nobody had told him about, but he had the insight to see that, and he knew also that he shouldn't touch the engines, because the engines were so full of volcanic ash, which is really hard silica, would have torn the turbines to pieces, and that would have been the end of it. And then he would have not only glided, but banged as well. So he had the insight to go down and not touch the engines till it was at about 2,000-3,000 feet. Not a bad fall from 30,000 feet to 2,000 feet. And he touched the engines. The other point is he brought the nose down a little bit, so as he went through the air cleaned the engines of all the hard little ash particles. That was Eric Moody, the captain of Speedbird 9. I think it's BA9, but somehow it's called Speedbird now. A book has been written about it. All four engines failed. At about 2,000 feet, he touched the button that got the engines going again. He then radioed and said, I know I meant to go on to New Zealand or something, but I'd rather land sooner if you don't mind. And so they got him somewhere and he landed. Everybody was euphoric. The passengers thought it was terrific. This is one of the passengers who wrote a book about it. They now invite him to a special dinner and bring him there somewhere in the world where everybody who's still around comes and toasts him and says how wonderful he was. All the BA officials thought it was fantastic at the airport he landed. I think it was Jakarta. And after about 20 minutes, when it died down a little bit, he said, well, thank you very much. I'd rather not do it again. But it's an interesting point that he had no access whatsoever to any previous knowledge, and he made the right decision. By the time he was going off, airline pilots all over the world knew what was going on, and yet they were stopped from flying. But that's another whole story. Anyhow, this is what Redoubt looks like. As I told you, the intrusion that he didn't fly through this one, but he flew through one that's very similar. And when he went off, the Met Office got a numerical program called NAME. N stands for numerical, I can never remember the other things, which basically was an advection diffusion model, and I'm afraid what I'm going to say is, the Met Office isn't wrong, but NAME, maybe NAME isn't wrong either. It works, it gives you answers, but advection diffusion is not what goes on here, and there is a really totally different process. Now, for those of you who want to go to sleep, it's after all afternoon, let me tell you what the home snippets are, what you're going to learn from this talk if you stay awake, and then so you'll know. Axisymmetric intrusions into a stratified median, that's what we're doing, do not spread, a simple analysis suggests. And I'll tell you some ways that you would be sure would be correct and normally are, but they aren't this time. They spread as a time-independent inner solution, I don't know why that's the wrong way around, with a small shock. They thin like one on R with radial distance R, as you see here. the external flow, like the wind, dominates after about 24 hours in umbrella clouds. And there's a width, which I'll show you, that goes like x to the 1/3 with downstream distance x. And there's good agreement, well, we'll talk about that, between various oceanographic data. Okay, they're the main ideas. Now, the simplest thing that you could say is, look, here it comes up, it intrudes at, let's say, 10 kilometers with a rate that's 2 pi q, so this is cubic meters per second or something, and it comes along in this axisymmetric cloud that extends to a radius rn of t, the radius of the nose, which changes with time, and has a typical thickness h, which will also change with time. Well, now conservation of volume says that r squared h has got to go like qt, that's why I put in the 2 pi here. Then there's the condition at the front of all of these intrusions that there's a Froude number, which is like a Mach number. It's the velocity u of the front divided by the velocity of long waves that could exist on this stratified system. So it's like a Mach number. That has to equal a Froude number. The Froude number is root 2 or 1.2. We could have a big discussion about that. Near enough to 1. So we have one equation, u dot is rn dot. U is rn dot. So we have one equation for rn dot and h, and another one, you can combine those, solve them, and you get that the radius got to go like t to the 2/3. The buoyancy frequency, n, that describes the stratification, q, the related to the volume flux, this Froude number, which is 1. And that's what you get by this simple analysis, and Andy Wood, the same guy as before, wrote a paper on that with Keneally in 1994. Now you could write down the governing equations. Mathematicians like to do it a little more carefully. You write down for an axisymmetric flow the local continuity equation that says ht plus basically qx is equal to zero, the momentum equation, which has the inertia terms here and the buoyancy term here, that's the momentum equation, and global continuity, which says there's got to be as much in the cloud as there is being put in. Okay, now you just balance these terms. That's the next thing that you do, and you say local continuity gives you nothing because both of these terms are of the same order. But the momentum says that r over t squared goes like n squared over h squared over r, which says that h goes like r over nt, and then global continuity, which says that h times r over t, because that's u times r, so hr squared over t, got to go like q. You put those together and you get exactly the same result. Oh, that looks good. Then you say the next step in mathematics is to say, well, we ought to have a similarity solution. Instead of depending upon r and t separately, we ought to be able to write a similarity variable that combines those two. This would be the appropriate form for the velocity and the height, and then you get some differential equations and you have to solve them numerically because it's nonlinear. F and G come in here and F squared here, but this is sort of standard stuff, and Barenblatt's book and lots of places do this. When you get this far, and I apologize a little bit, there's going to be quite a bit of mathematics in the next 2-3 slides. That's why I told you that in part, that take home snippets. Those of you who are asleep and don't care about mathematics can just take it home. Okay. There's no solution to this. What? Roger Bonacase was a wonderful postdoc of mine, and I told him to solve these nonlinear equations numerically, and he came back and he said, I can't get a solution. And I said to him something politely, like, we'll go back and try again, but I thought, you bloody idiot, of course there's a solution, what are you doing? So he went back and he came all the time. It became a boring week. He would come each morning and say, I've tried really hard, I'm decreasing, I just can't get a solution. Yes?
Just one question.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I
haven't really, but what we have is the inflow here at the radius that we're given by the Q, and the Froude number at the front here, and those are the sufficient conditions.
So when you say there's no solution, you mean with
with those. Well, that's an interesting point. I think there are no solutions with almost any boundary conditions. But of course, if the boundary conditions was f and g were equal to zero at the two ends, then f and g could equal zero everywhere, and that it would be a solution. Can I defer that question? There are definitely no solutions with this boundary condition. For reasons that I'll explain in a minute, I don't think there are boundary conditions with any, solutions with any boundary condition, but that's a good point. And Anya Slim, another graduate student of mine, looked at a somewhat similar, but not exactly the same problem. And she got into the same difficulties, but with her, I knew it. I told her, try and do this, you'll find you can't do it. I think that's a good question. And it's partly this, that here's the similarity variable. And you can calculate h of y, and you march from here, where you have the Froude condition, and you go in, and you find it goes to infinity. And it goes to infinity, it just can't get to the origin. And I think that's independent. It's marching from here, and that's why this boundary condition, I'll have to think a little bit more about. I can't answer you. Well, I'm going to think some more about it. But it goes up, and that was where Roger and I got into terrible trouble. I said to him, well, your mesh scale is just not small enough. Make it smaller, smaller, smaller when you get here, and you'll find it can't go to infinity, but it can. And it did, and you went down to zero. That didn't matter so much. But h went to infinity, and that was a problem. With Anya, I was more aware of this. Now, what we're going to say is if that's not right, the similarity solution is not correct, then we'll have a different idea that there's a steady response, except right at the front, and that steady response then will be linked in to what goes on in the front. It's steady, so we'll write down the equations leaving the ddt term out. This front condition is not relevant because doesn't hold it to the front. We just have these conditions, and out of that we can say basically that u squared plus a quarter n squared h squared is equal to b, and this is of course the Bernoulli equation, and that's why I called b the constant, and this is a quadratic, so there must be two solutions. And I'm going to go a little rapidly through the mathematics, because if it doesn't mean anything to you, it doesn't matter how slow I do it. If it does mean something to you, I can do it quickly and you'll understand. There are two solutions, a supercritical and a subcritical one, in terms of this parameter g, which has these constants in here, and then goes down with r squared. And you can fairly easily show that the subcritical one is irrelevant, because it won't fit the boundary condition. You can work out what b is just for this one. This is the only solution that's going to be possible. And what that looks like is this non-dimensional u, which I call u prime, is pretty constant with r, and then it comes in drops down. So there's not as large a velocity at the beginning as there is at an end, and that of course is because it's squashed down. And h, the non-dimensional h, goes down like 1 on r. Now, this is not going to work exactly in this experiment. This is not axisymmetric, etc., etc. But you did see it was going down, and you also saw in the volcano that it was going down. Now you need an unsteady response to that, which is just at the front. So you write down the full equations, and as I say, I'm going to go a little quickly. You have a shock that is at RS of t, and it moves with a speed c to link into that steady solution. And that says that Rn goes like t to the 3/4, not to the 2/3, but to the 3/4. And the shock gets closer and closer to the nose relatively with time, but after a few minutes for a volcanic situation. And so the shock is pretty much at the nose. So it's all steady, as I'll show you in a minute, except for the shock, which you see here. So this is as a function of radius. This is what it would look like for 25 non-dimensional times steady like this, and then there's a shock here, and I've drawn that by hand just to make it clear. I've made it bigger than it actually is. Then at 50, it's the same here. It's got to be the same shape, and then it extends out to there, and then there's another little shock, and then on to 100 and so on and so on. So it's steady thinning with a shock on the front. Now, this comes to answer the question, why is there no similarity solution? What I haven't yet said is, if this was two-dimensional, then there is a similarity solution. No problem. If it's an axisymmetric constant volume intrusion, or a two-dimensional constant volume intrusion, there's a similarity solution. What makes this special? Well, what you need to have a similarity solution is a unique L of T, and I cite the Russian bear here. Some of you will know Grisha Baranblat. I don't know how many of you know him. He was here for a long time. He was quite a character, and we called him the Russian bear, and I could give a whole seminar on Grisha, but I won't. He proved that there need to be, and it's in his book, and what you find is that the parameters you're looking for are M, and basically B, the Bernoulli constant, and that says that in two dimensions, it'll look like this, and it goes like time, and all is fine. But when it's axisymmetric constant flux, then these are the relevant factors. There's no unique L because both the Bernoulli constant and this constant can be brought together to give L, and there's the and then you've got T as well, so you can get two different sorts of L's, no unique L of T, and then as Grisha says, there's no similarity solution. And I think that answers your question, that it's independent of the initial condition, but I must admit I never thought of that before. Okay, now rather quickly, let's go, one thing I should say. Is my colleague, my Australian colleague, Jörg Imberger, not knowing any of this, well, no, only knowing a little bit of it, knowing the Woods and Keneally thing, did some large-scale experiments in a lake. He's a limnologist, and it didn't spread like T to the 2/3, but it went like T to the 3/4. So he thought, well, that doesn't agree with the theory, but they're the observations. And then he made what I think is an important mistake, and I'm saying this for all of you to know, when theory and experiment don't agree, or theory and field observations, it's always, 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 I exaggerate, the theory that's wrong. It's not the field observations that are wrong. But he thought, oh, well, I must have made a mistake because the theory says. And so he published it in a very uninfluential place, because he said, well, I have the theory from Woods and Keneally, and the experiments don't agree, so, but I did the experiments, let's publish them. Mistake. Should have said Woods and Keneally were wrong, but that would have taken some courage. Now, you look at the effects of drag, as I said, after a day or so, something like that, for a volcano, but of course it would differ enormously from what sort of intrusion. Then you find that drag plays a role, and it changes this sign again from 3/4 to 5/9. Now, you might say, what's the difference? Over a long enough time, it makes a difference. Now, what about the effects of wind? On the very first photograph that I showed you, wind plays a role because it drags the plume, the intrusion, downstream. So you write down this now in two dimensions, not axisymmetric, that's what I mean. There's a downstream, a cross-stream, and a up. So it's that many dimensions. You need continuity, you have a drag due to the wind, and that tells you that the width increases like x to the 1/3. So the width versus downstream distance is x to the 3rd. And what it looks like is seen here. This is now for typical values, so that you can see kilometers and thicknesses of the plume in kilometers. The eruption point is here at 0, 0. It goes a little bit upstream, But taking typical values for the eruption, I could change this slide quite reasonably, but taking typical values of the eruption, it only goes 10 kilometers, let's say, upstream. That might not even be 10. And then it's forced back by the wind. And it winds, excuse me, like X to the third. And it's quite thick here, as you see, something like 2 kilometers. But as it goes downstream, it gets less and less thick. And this is an explanation of why, over Europe, planes weren't allowed to fly. But there was no problem in planes flying around and landing at Reykjavik Airport, which is just 40, 50 miles away from Volcano E. But it was upstream, and that was perfectly safe. But downstream, they thought it wasn't safe. I might just say, because it brings in an interesting question of risk, because I like talking about risk. Most people don't know, but the engines on planes are owned by the engine manufacturers and leased by the airlines. So BA doesn't own those four things that go round, but they're owned by Rolls-Royce. And the engine manufacturers were very keen to stop the planes flying in the air, because they argued, as far as they understood risk, if something was to happen, if there was even one plane going down, that might be quite a problem for the airline industry. And they didn't want that. They would lose income from selling engines. And if they said to the airlines, you can't fly for 2 weeks, they lost 2 weeks' rental. Big deal. That was well worth it. For the airline companies, there's a different evaluation of risk. Of course, for them, there were lots of passengers that were annoyed, a lot of passengers who had to be put up at their expense. Some of the smaller airlines went bust. So they really were not at all pleased about what went on. And you recall the CEO of BA, whose name I've just forgotten, went up in the air and showed that it was quite safe, which it definitely was. And then there's the third risk, which is, if you're a potential passenger, what risk would you take to fly under rather certain circumstances? You might be willing to take a 20-30% chance, even if the flight was to take you to your mother's funeral, your wedding. For some reason, you might be willing to take that risk. So there's a whole variation of risks, and people didn't, I think, totally understand that. Anyhow, here's I think it just shows the streamlines that you see as it goes. This is now the eruption of E, and you see that we say that the spread should go like X to the one third, which it agrees very well. But let me say immediately, this is a typical theoretician's model. It assumes that the wind direction is all in one direction. The wind is in one direction. There's no variation in time of the buoyancy frequency, the stratification frequency. And that, of course, isn't true. In reality, the wind moves around and things like that. So I think this is rather a good agreement. And it gives you the ideas, I think, of what could possibly go on. Now, that leads me to a slide which even the authors of the paper disagree violently, and it's fascinating to me that the disagreement is correlated with age. Now, I don't want to say that this proves anything, but there is definitely a correlation, and just because it's correlated doesn't mean it's causal, but it's interesting. The older people, and I say softly, I'm one of those, think this is a wonderful graph, and the young postdocs don't like it at all. What it does is as follows. It shows the plume width as a function of downstream distance, and the relationship we developed, W goes like X to the third, is shown here. Now, the older people say as follows. Look, this is fabulous. This goes like X to the third, pretty much. This goes like X to the third. These are a number of different eruptions, and this is the Volcano E. Look, the older people, look, it's fabulous. It goes extremely well. And they will say, yeah, look, there's no agreement here whatsoever, of course. But that's because we're talking about 300 kilometers downstream, and the wind isn't going to be in one direction 300 kilometers downstream. It's going to have changed direction, and it changes the situation, there's no doubt. And here again, it changes the situation because it's a model. And here again, the youngsters say, no, it doesn't go properly like W to the third. I disagree with them, but I'm presenting both of you. I think this is very interesting. We're still continuing to work on this, trying to get more data. And also, it's what really would be nice is to put in the pre-multiplicative constants, which we've done, but it's difficult to get exact values of them. And then there are error bars, and the error bars are reasonable. But these curves, well, again, oldies like me say they collapse quite well. The youngsters seem to think they don't collapse that well. Let me just say in a penultimate slide, buoyancy, which I've told you is the most important, the density difference into this stratified medium, beats advection diffusion of the Met Office, and I prove that on this slide by saying what's relevant is the Peclet number, which is some velocity times a length scale times some diffusion coefficient. So it's the time scale for diffusion over the time scale of advection. And the horizontal and vertical Peclet numbers, because you can put in horizontal velocities, horizontal length scale, horizontal or vertical diffusion coefficients. Now, the velocity is roughly or goes like the length on time. The vertical velocity from continuity, if you like, goes like the height on time, or it goes just like that. L squared H goes like QT, that's conservation. And so you can get expressions for the Peclet numbers. Now, the diffusion coefficients, the normal coefficients that you might get, or typical coefficients you might get by measurements, are given here. And now, typical values for a volcano, for Q, 10 to the 10th cubic meters per second, goes about 500 kilometers in a day and 2,000 kilometers after 10 days, says that the vertical Peclet number after a day is 10 cubed. After 10 days, it's 30. That's the smallest entry here, as you see. The horizontal Peclet number is 10 to the 5th. After 10 days, it gets even larger. These are all very much larger than 1. An applied mathematician thinks 30 is very, very much larger than 1. It says that diffusion is unimportant. So the Met Office is wrong. I once gave this seminar, and a man put his hand up at the back and said, but I was a member of the Met Office who wrote the program. And I said, and what? And he said, so it's not wrong. What could I say? Okay, here are the conclusions. We know that volcanic eruptions can cause lots of difficulty for flying, but it's interesting how it causes a difficulty, and that needs to be looked at, and that's almost the point of another seminar. Forecasting dispersion is really important to ensure the safety of airlines and the engines, I guess. It's important to look at the spreading due to buoyancy in a stratified atmosphere, and I should have really talked about spreading due to buoyancy for pollution release or for an intrusion in a ocean or a lake. We've looked at the non-similar axisymmetric motions. It's one of the few cases that I know of where it seems that a similarity solution should work, but it just doesn't. And we've also looked at the effects of drag and wind, which can be very important. I think there's good agreement with various observational data. To be fair to the young postdocs, they don't think the agreement is that good, but they're wrong. I'm reminded a little bit, I occasionally talk about carbon capture and storage, and I say that climate change is probably happening. And my young son gets very annoyed and said, no, Daddy, it's terrible to say it's probably happening. You have to say it is definitely happening. And I say, well, you know, I think it's only probable. He gets annoyed with me. Anyhow, finally, advection diffusion models, which were quickly brought up by the Met Office, and I understand that they needed to quickly get some numerical scheme. where you have advection by the wind and turbulent diffusion, so that plays an important role, is unphysical. And I always find it fascinating. They can only get good agreement with observations if they put in huge diffusion coefficients. That never seems to bother them, these parameters. And you may know the story. With three parameters, I can describe an elephant. And with a fourth, I can make him fly. Well, I don't want to make elephants fly. What I want to do is say there's still a lot of heat and energy in volcanic eruptions, and I hope you've enjoyed the talk. It depends on the stratification, on the rate at which you're putting things into the plume at the base, Q, N, and I think, of course, G prime, the difference in density initially at the source between the atmosphere or the fluid and that. And that determines how high it goes. And the thing that I would say is that the coefficient of alpha that I mentioned is about 0.1, comes into this very importantly. And George Batchelor realized that when they started working on this. And so he said to an extremely capable experimenter, Stuart Turner, measure in the lab how high up it goes. In other words, make measurements like this, but in a proper axisymmetric situation. And said to Morton, said to Bruce Morton, you do the theory, do the numerical calculations with alpha coming in, and Stuart Turner will make the measurements. And they worked extremely well, and that's where they got the 0.1 from. And we hadn't the slightest idea how to evaluate that other than numerically until about 2 or 3 years ago. So what Andy Woods did is he took experiments to getting alpha in the laboratory where Stuart Turner talks in 1956 of 6-inch risers, they were inches in those days, 6-inch risers, and applied them to volcanic eruptions, which are 45 kilometers at the most extent. Now, I think that's the second biggest extrapolation that I know of looking at a laboratory experiment to actuality. Well, you may know of some bigger ones, I'd be interested to know. I'm not going to tell you, but what's the biggest extrapolation, which makes from 6 inches to 45 kilometers look minute? Anyhow, next question. Madam. I'm not hearing you very well. This is the question of the value of alpha, yeah?
No, the value of the drag coefficient of the intrusion.
The lack of the...
Of the intrusion, yeah. Where you included the drag coefficient and
yeah.
The different moment.
Oh, coefficient. Is the drag coefficient low, 0.01?
Yeah.
You could, of course, argue that. I think that's a reasonable value, but I think one of the things of a model like this is if you think it's 10 times too small, put in 10 times larger and see what happens. I think that's a reasonable value, but there are no doubt huge variations. One thing I'm sure everybody will agree is to write it in terms of a drag coefficient and U mod U squared, U mod U. That isn't right, but it's not a bad approximation. At least it's dimensionally correct.
Yeah. So following up on that.
Yeah. I don't think that plays a large role. The added mass you're saying because of the entrainment that comes in. I don't think that makes much of a difference.
Would sort of have the same, it would still be proportional to U squared.
Yeah.
It would be on the left hand side. And that might sort of compensate for the low drag coefficient.
Well, my experience is that putting in added mass due to entrainment is not necessary. I think one of Paul Linden's students has looked into that. Oh, well, there may be more, and there may be aspects I don't know about that. But I don't think that plays a large role. But, I mean, you know, if you want to say you want to be absolutely correct, it's definitely true.
Yeah.
Most of my experience comes from majority of my experience comes from gravity currents, where also there's entrainment. I mean, the current goes along the horizontal. That doesn't make a difference there. I don't know of a case where entrainment plays a role.